Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speakers are Stixrud and Anderson, and they will be speaking on the church as a healthcare system. So let's listen in on them.
O loving God, creator of all good and gracious gifts, we drink in your marvelous handiwork, the spectacular mountaintops, waterfalls, deer and forests, and each person present in this place. We feel the wonder of being created in your image, but you know our forgetfulness of whose we are, our willfulness of trying to live life on our own terms, and the pain of reaching the bottom of our own shallow pits. And then, our Creator Redeemer, you invite us to be healed at your feast of love and to participate in the depths of your goodness. We pray our thanks in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I'm Annette Stixrud, and I'm coordinator of Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries, which is based in Portland, Oregon. And this is Judy Anderson, and she is the president of the board of directors of Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries. Keep doing that to me. And we will, tonight is kind of the foundation of parish nursing. And on Wednesday night, we're going to go on in the area of wellness. And it's balancing your life is more than an act, but it will stand alone. And on Thursday night is the loneliest people in the church, teens. And on Friday, violence pays. You do too. And so those will all be different aspects of parish nursing, but tonight we want to give you the very basis. Now, we know that preaching, teaching, and healing are commanded for us to do. And that you can find this in throughout the scriptures. And I want to give you kind of a whole view on health. Do any of you know what Americans died of mostly in the 1880s? Well, that was one of them, sure.
Infection.
Okay. Yeah, and we put that kind of under environmental diseases. This is poor water supplies, lack of immunization. And medical science has done a wonderful job of making sure that we no longer die of those things. At least we don't have to. How about the 1980s? What do people die of? Okay. Okay. Well, we call them, what people die of mostly, our lifestyle diseases. And it was already alluded to, but in the year 2010, what is going to be the leading cause of death? Someone said gunshot wounds, and it is violence. And with that in mind, I would like to read from John 5. Starting at verse 2. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Hebrew called Bethesda, which has five porticos. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him and knew that he had been lying there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is troubled. And while I am going, another steps down before me." And Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your pallet and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his pallet and walked. Now Jesus asks the question, "Do you want to be healed?" And the man doesn't answer. He gives a whole lot of excuses. Well, that's one of the things that we are here to give you some ideas how the church might become a true healthcare system. And we do have to ask the question, do we want to be healed? And because Judy and I didn't trust the fact that you might just listen to us, we brought in the big guns. I mean, people you're going to listen to. Judy's going to tell you about that.
We have a part of a video that we'd like you to see, and this video was formed from a generous grant from Lutheran Brotherhood several years ago. What they had done is the Carter Center of Emory University in Atlanta and Wheat Ridge Foundation got together and had an unprecedented symposium in 1989 where they called together public health officials, politicians, health leaders, and religious leaders. And what they did is talk about what the church, what the role of the church is, what the role of religious communities is in regard to health, what the church isn't doing, what the church is doing. And they had in all about 30 Christian denominations, plus Muslim, Jewish, Native American people participating. What they did is look at what their faith traditions said about health and healing, and what some of the gaps were and what was actually supposed to happen and what was actually happening. This conference was a follow-up to a conference in 1984, which actually was called Closing the Gap. It was called The Burden of Unnecessary Illness. And I'm going to read those gaps to you because this will come up in the video, and I think we are showing a segment of it so you won't have some of the background. The gaps are between what's known and what's done about disease prevention. And there are five of them. The first gap is the gap between what is known and what is applied, the gap between what faith groups affirm regarding health and what they really do. The third is the gap between successful models that are being practiced and general application. Fourth is the gap perpetuated by faith groups working in isolation, not knowing what other people are doing. And the fifth one, which was added later actually, was the gap between the world's current deeds and future needs. And you're hearing a lot about that at Holden Village, so I think you can relate to that. The symposium that you're going to see on video, I'd like to read you the overall objective, because this will help explain what's happening, was to seek new ways to involve the church more fully in building healthy lives for all people. And so that included their own congregation, their own faith community, plus their responsibility to the world community as a whole. And they were doing this for decreasing unnecessary suffering, preventing disease, disability, and premature death, and improving the quality of life. So following, we have about a 15-minute segment that we'd like to share with you. We're going to show an introductory portion, and you'll see some people that you recognize on here, and then we'll discuss how this applies to the church.
He starts with the leading causes of death in our society.
Infectious diseases, infant mortality, substance abuse, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dental disease, alcoholism, unintentional injury, and homicide and suicide. Together, these 14 primary causes are responsible for 90% of the potential years of life lost because people die unnecessarily.
We discovered that two-thirds of the premature deaths are preventable just by our own personal habits. We personally start with all of the things that we can change. Letting people die when they don't have to die, letting 37 million Americans be out of the range of health care. That's where we fail to accept responsibility.
We simply have to teach that we do have a responsibility for others, and that the idea of love your neighbor is not just a religious idea. It becomes ultimately the measure of civilization. The measure of civilization is not found in knowledge or technology or even happiness. The measure of civilization is how we treat each other.
Maybe if we were to come to some road between Jerusalem and Jericho, we might have the opportunity to see who the new person is lying in the middle of the road.
Health is too important to just leave it to the doctors. That's what former Atlanta Mayor Andrew Young said at the beginning of a national symposium on health at the Carter Center. Attending were representatives of more than 30 Christian denominations and faith communities. At the symposium, religious leaders found common ground in their faith groups' traditions and commitment to health and healing. But they also struggled with the challenge to find ways in which they, as people of faith, could and should close the gap between what the status of health is and what it could be for Americans and for a whole world in need. And they discovered it's a matter of life and death.
While Annette is fast-forwarding it, this is a videotape that's available to use in congregations for them to work through with study guides what their role can be in health. And this is segment two. There are five segments, each about 25 minutes. And we send all of our parish nurses out with this videotape to get them started in their church communities.
Let's work with the church.
Kathleen Newman wrote in World Watch, quote, "No cold statistic expresses more eloquently the difference between a society of sufficiency and a society of deprivation than infant mortality. America's infant mortality rate ranks 22nd among industrialized nations. Our rate is twice as high as Japan. Black infant mortality is double the white rate. The rates for white ranks only 12th worldwide."
And so the infant mortality rate, whether or not our children are able to survive the first year of life, tells you about your society more clearly and eloquently than any other determinant. And that means that you who are in the business and in the concerns of the spiritual realm, of the church world, of the synagogues, of the mosques, all of you, have got to be fundamentally concerned then about whether or not the babies are surviving for the first year of life.
We estimate that 10,000 of the 40,000 babies who die each year in our country could be saved by just applying what we know about access to prenatal care, case management, outreach, and home visiting. The savings in human and economic terms could be enormous. For example, in 1988, the hospital costs alone for low birth weight babies was in the range of $2 billion annually. The costs, however, of providing early prenatal care to every woman not receiving it now would be as little as $500 million. Children are our hope. They're our future, they're our posterity.
The church is the contents of the nation. And the church has to raise the issues and say, you know, this is intolerable for us to be allowing some of our citizens to die because their skin is a different color, because they're a different ethnic background, simply because they're poor.
All of the things we have heard about the inequities domestically have to be multiplied by 10, 100, 1,000. To understand the inequities in the developing world. Dr. Marty said, we don't want to go back to the 16th century. But I will assure you that today, October 26th, tens of thousands of children are being born into the 16th century. They will be born and live short lives with no benefit from all of the medical schools in the world. No benefit because penicillin was discovered. No benefit because we have computers or even an alphabet. They will receive no benefit because we have an American Medical Association or because we have organized churches.
Globally, the number one cause of disease is poverty. And the United States is no exception. And the speakers this afternoon have underlined that. And if we're not doing something about poverty, we're not doing something about health.
Now, there's good news about progress against the diseases which kill Americans today. Smoking is down about 25% over the past 20 years. This is a major public health gain against such diseases as lung cancer, emphysema, and heart disease. The decrease in lung cancer in males parallels the decrease in smoking, while it is still increasing for women. Tobacco advertising targeted to women and the poor and minorities, however, is still winning converts to the ranks of smokers.
We're all involved now in this narcissism, this self-aggrandizement, this living for today, whether it be the people on Wall Street or whether it be the young black male in the inner city selling drugs. We're so engaged in doing things to achieve purposes of outer value that we forget the inner value, the rapture that is associated with being alive, and so that people in the black community in particular are bombarded every single day with billboards that are as big as you can imagine, with every magazine that people of color read, constantly showing you the symbols of America. Fancy ball gowns, looking very cool, being in Bermuda on vacation, riding off into the sunset on a motorcycle. Do you want to be hip, cool, sexy girl, masculine, in charge, what's happening, the way to be? Do you want to be all the things that Entertainment Tonight, People Magazine, Lifestyles, Rich and Famous, and Dynasty tells you you're supposed to want to be, the American ideal? Compare your contemporary social reality with that image. Does it compare? Of course not. Want to close the gap? Buy a cigarette. We can pretend. And we pretend our way to death and disease at incredible rates. The church is fundamentally involved in the process of defining what the symbols and images, the ideal of what America is supposed to be. We have gone so far off track, it's going to be very, very hard to get this back.
What's controlling the United States of America today is profits. The money interests have taken over. And somehow we've got to get back in control of the country and keep it from destroying itself from the inside out.
I guess we want to know more about the political side of health issues. Let's talk about the tobacco industry, for example.
It's protected by the White House. It's protected by Congress. Both those things, I think, are reprehensible. And although we have made tremendous progress against smoking in this country, the tobacco companies now, with the apparent consent and aid of the White House trade representative, are exporting disease, disability, and death to the third world and placing on them a health burden that they will never recover from.
We learned that the primary killer of American people is a horrible drug, the most addictive drug of all. Last year, responsible for the deaths of 390,000 Americans. Cigarettes. And how little is done about it, and how timid people are to speak up and say, this is a problem that we can indeed address. It's sobering to me, though, that more Colombians died last year from American cigarettes than Americans died from Colombian cocaine, crack.
In the past 25 years, mortality rates for coronary heart disease declined 40% and for stroke 25%, due in large part to the control of high blood pressure, cholesterol, and smoking. Now, these illustrations show promising progress, but we have yet much work to do.
And still we sit or stand mute on this devastating affliction on our society. We see young people, because we are mute, acquire a habit which they cannot break. It's much more addictive than heroin, because they think, from the church leaders, from the religious leaders, from the educational leaders, the parents, that it's okay.
Cigarettes ought and just definitely have to be banned from the church environment, the church community. I think you can control that. That's something that you can do. You can say, nah, this is a place of life. We're not in the business of death. Take that nonsense outside.
We said yesterday that life expectancy at birth has increased by 25 years during the century. That's 25 years at birth. At my age, I can expect only 6 more years than my grandfather had at the same age. In one sense, that means that all of 20th century science and medicine can provide me only 6 additional years of life at this age. On the other hand, Lester Breslow in Alameda County in California has shown that a person my age, doing some simple things, not smoking, drinking only in moderation, eating right, exercising, and so forth, a person my age can live 11 years longer than a person my age not doing those things. So in one sense, I am twice as powerful as all of 20th century science and medicine in determining my own health destiny. Now, that is real power, and that's where the church should be dealing with individuals and showing them what they can do. And then this hits you immediately into smoke enders clinics and AA groups and Weight Watchers and counseling and aerobics and flu vaccinations and so forth.
The purpose of this conference is to deal with the gap between what is known about health promotion and disease prevention and what is applied by the citizens of this nation. I've learned that if you don't believe in your own self-worth, if it doesn't matter to you whether you live or die, if the world is only as immediate as today, if the only concerns you have is me, mine, now, then what difference does it make whether you smoke cigarettes and you're going to get cancer when you're 50? The work that we have to do and that you are uniquely able to do is to till that soil that says that we care about ourselves as human beings. We believe in our own self-worth.
What effect on the national psyche do you believe your blunt statements on AIDS has made on how people understand the disease?
The most discouraging thing about it is that we have not been able to change the behavior of the target group we are most interested in now, and that is teenagers. But teenagers who, just by their nature, are risk takers, who don't like anything that begins in the way of an admonition with the word don't, who think they're immortal, have not changed their behavior. And I think the time has come to face the fact that teenagers will not change behavior because of fear of the consequences of that behavior, and we have to appeal to them on a moral basis.
Well, you know, maybe when I hit 25 I ought to worry about AIDS, or maybe I ought to worry about becoming an addict when I hit 25, but I know that some people don't realize they're actually addicts now, and that they could get AIDS now, they could become pregnant now. I think they're still feeling that youthful immortality. I can't die yet because I haven't done enough.
Don't worry about it till tomorrow. What are you going to do about that?
I think there are a lot of people on campus, including myself, who are thinking, well, we ought to make decisions now, and saying to our friends and to our family that we are important and we are human, so that means we could die now.
We should be teaching parishioners and ourselves about prevention versus treatment. Hippocrates said, the function of protecting and developing health must rank even above that of restoring it when it is impaired. This is true. It's true in medicine, but we don't live that way. That's not where the money goes. We don't practice it. It's also true in religion, but we don't like to practice it. I have heard theologians interpret the New Testament as saying it talks about healing, not prevention. Therefore, the church should be involved in healing, not prevention. The fact seems to me that sins were forgiven because that was not the desired state. And it was even made explicit, go and sin no more.
I'd like to address the issue of prevention. How can we get the churches be able to develop programs which will also draw on their sympathy and be able to get excited about things which are not as excitable like prevention?
I think that's why we're here, in part, is to help prevent emergence. Because that's not, it's not just the churches that don't get excited about prevention, it's the medical and nursing communities who don't always get excited about prevention, and it's the newspapers who don't get excited about prevention stories.
Reverend Walter Warnick has said, ministers feel more comfortable with repair because prevention feels as though you are fixing something that isn't broken. Quite the contrary. The continuum of illness starts early but doesn't break the surface of consciousness until late. Clarence McCabe, the high school football coach, he died at age 47 of lung cancer. And before he died, he said, it's hard to get across the idea to teenagers that it's not the last pack of cigarettes that killed you, it's the first. Things are broken with that first cigarette. So the point is one of perspective. Everything can be seen as healing from that perspective. Everything we do is healing, only the brokenness isn't evident to everyone. On the other hand, all efforts can be seen as prevention, as we attempt to prevent illness, as we attempt to prevent the progression of illness, as we attempt to prevent disability, or prevent suffering, or prevent pain, or prevent death.
We have a whole generation of people now who patronize salad bars, and they jog, and they worry about smoking, and they worry about drinking. They're concerned about the ingestion of fats. They're worried about stress. But we don't know yet whether that's a fad of this generation, or whether they really have learned and will profit by it and pass it on to their children.
You were impressed by these big guns that we called in. We figured that people sometimes listen to big names, and we hope that that happened. Actually, I have one more big name to quote from. This is from Jimmy Carter, and I like what he says here. Wouldn't it be wonderful if faith groups, a Baptist church, a Catholic mission, a Jewish congregation, a Muslim center, adopted one close-by geographical area and made sure that every single child in the neighborhood was immunized against the basic diseases, that there was no hungry person in that area, that every person had a basic medical exam, that every woman who became pregnant would get prenatal care, that every elderly person was contacted daily. Suppose these congregations convinced parents and children to fight the presence of guns. Suppose they made a commitment to provide the kinds of alternatives needed to reduce the violence that afflicts the poorest among us. These are very exciting and very redemptive options for the faith groups of our nation. But are they possible? We believe the answer is yes. And how might that be possible? Oh, yeah. Well, we of course are here to tell you about parish nursing, which is the possible. And I highly recommend the parish nurse book that has been written by Granger Westberg. And just to give you a little bit of a background in Granger, if I can remember what I did with my notes. Granger is a Lutheran pastor from the Chicago area, and in 1952 to 1964, he was on the medical and theological faculties at the University of Chicago. And he noted that about one-third of all the patients that he saw really should have been seen when they were just a little bit sick, that they would not have ended up in a university hospital. And he said he felt that if someone had picked up their cries for help at the beginning, that their problems would have been reversible. He said that these people told him experiences in their life outside observers had seen in these clinics. And what they said was they were particularly impressed with the openness to creative ways of dealing with the whole patient. They saw nurses as the catalyst in getting representatives of medicine and theology to talk with each other. Westberg describes the nurse as one with her foot in, one foot in the humanities and the other in sciences, and found that that bridged the unnecessary gap that often exists between the two. Thus was born the idea of a parish nurse. And the specific work of the nurses has always varied according to the setting of a given church. But the primary thrust of the nurse's work was to identify that early cry for help and to intervene before problems required hospitalization. So nurses, parish nurses, do most of their work in the areas of prevention and in wellness. So it's health promotion. And I'm going to have ask Judy to give you a, just a short history of Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries, since she was there at the birthing of this, and I wasn't.
And what pains. Well, there is a very strong national movement, and I think you've seen that from the videotape. There's a National Parish Nurse Resource Center that's headed, headquartered in near Chicago, Illinois, in Park Ridge. How many of you are from the Northwest? Less than half. Okay. So you should know that what we're saying here is also duplicated in most of the areas in the country. The groundwork for Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries, which really serves the entire Northwest region, including Northern California, Alaska, and all the states around here, was really laid in about 1989 when a group of people from the Oregon Synod of the ELCA and from the Mission Affairs Committee of Emmanuel Hospital in Portland got together and decided to have a conference introducing the concept of parish nursing to the Northwest area, particularly the Oregon region. For that conference, they called in Granger Westberg, who was one of the speakers, along with Anne Solari Twaddell, who is the head of the National Parish Nurse Resource Center, and Jim Wiley, pastor who has been very involved from the beginning of parish nursing at Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge. They gave a presentation that was attended by about 75 participants, mostly nurses and clergy. And at that time it was asked, is there an interest in looking further into parish nursing or health ministries in our region? About, more than 50% of the people answered yes and signed a list to help us and to look at how they could assist us in getting this off the ground. As a result of that, there was a conference planned for 1989, actually. The conference that we had was the first one. 2 years later, our first of the next series of conferences, and this year we've had the fifth annual conference, was held. But during the time in the interim, we had a grant from Wheat Ridge Foundation in Chicago that helped us get a feasibility study off the ground. A coordinator was hired for that to look at the chances of introducing it to churches and to groups throughout the Northwest. And she actually did a lot of speaking with churches, mostly in Oregon and Washington, and found there was indeed a great deal of interest. This spawned another conference in 1991. And at that time, we again had people from the national scene coming together. In 1991, the end of 91, we looked at developing a program based on a Wheat Ridge grant where Annette would be hired as our coordinator. And it's through her efforts that we were able to bring an educational program to the Northwest, to have networking throughout the churches in the region, and to look at support groups that are developing to sustain the nurses once they have finished the educational programs. At this point, we have 160 nurses that have completed the basic program, and they come from Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Northern California, Alaska, and some of them have even moved on to Arkansas and places east. And we have a very strong network. But we find that it's not important enough just to educate the nurses, but to keep them apprised of what's going on. So we'll be sharing with you, in fact, I have some of the things listed up there for what Northwest Parish Nurse Ministry does. Annette runs monthly support groups for the nurses in the Portland area, and we encourage support groups elsewhere because they're actually pioneers in a new role, and it helps to talk about what's happening and new ways to do things. The educational programs are enhanced by newsletters and information that Annette sends out. And I think one of the things that we like to do is just let people know that there are as many possibilities as there are churches. Each church has its own individual style. What works for one church is not necessarily the best approach for another church. And so we encourage them to keep looking at assessing the needs. And those of you that are in nursing know that one of the first things we do is assess the situation before we start devising a plan.
And I just wanted to share some of the stories with you, and then we'll open it up for questions. This last week, on Wednesday afternoon, we finished another training for parish nurses. And it was, when we first, at the very end, we have what we call a healing service, because many nurses have never been a part of what it is like to be a part of a healing service. And at the beginning of that healing service, we said, okay, you've gone through the parish nurse class, you have an idea of how to begin parish nursing in your parish or in your congregation. What do you see that you're going to use this knowledge for? How are you going to begin? And one of the first nurses said, well, my church is pretty much together. I'll probably start by doing a blood pressure clinic, because that way you get to know the people, you identify hypertension, but it is a good place. It's a good place to touch people and let them tell you some of their needs. Well, 2 hours later, and almost every nurse said about the same thing, well, I think I will, maybe do a newsletter article. 2 hours later, now the one question in this healing service after a very short talk by the pastor, the question was, is there anything you would like us to pray for in your life? There were 18 nurses. 2 hours later, when probably only 10 actually chose to have something prayed for in their life, there were more tears than I think I have ever seen. There was a really deep, deep sharing of needs and a deep sharing of hurts in people's lives. And the same nurse that had started out saying, well, my congregation looks like they have it together, said at the end of the service, she said, I remember what I said when I came into this room. And she said, I realize what my congregation looks like on the surface, but I know now what is in the depths. She said, they can't be any different than the people in this room. And she said, we all looked pretty together. Another nurse shared with us this week, a parish nurse from the Portland area came in to share an experience that she had just had at her church. And that was a young couple that had come to her to tell her that the wife, she was in her early 30s, had been diagnosed with a brain tumor, and that the prognosis was that she probably had a little less than 2 months to live. And what they wanted as a family from their parish nurse was someone who would case manage so that the wife could stay in the home with the small children and be with her husband and children. And so what the parish nurse was able to do was to coordinate between the visiting nurses and the people in the congregation who provided meals, who provided childcare, transportation, whatever was needed in that family. And they said that the visiting nurses marveled over and over again and said, this is the way it should be. This is really the way it should be. And the mother lost consciousness just about 24 hours before she died. But this nurse said, I have never witnessed such a peaceful, healing death. And she said that family has just felt so surrounded by the church community, which will continue to surround them. And then another story I like to tell is the parish nurse that went to the nursing home, and she said, I can't even tell you why I even said this. But she was calling on a member of the congregation, and she said to this elderly woman with Alzheimer's, and what will happen to you when you die? And the woman said, they'll put me in the garbage can. And the nurse said, no. When you die, you will go to heaven to be with God. And she looked at her and she said, I know that's important what you're telling me, but I can't remember it. Would you tell me again? And so the nurse repeated, when you die, you will go to be with God, and Jesus is preparing a place for you. And she said, oh, I just can't remember it. And so the nurse said, I'll write it down for you. And she said all she could find was a paper towel. And she wrote it on the paper towel. And the next morning, they found the woman had died very peacefully in her sleep, clutching what the nurse had written. So there are so many ways that nurses can minister within their congregation, and as partnerships form with the pastors, can extend the ministry of the church. And maybe we can bring back some of that healing that has so long been gone from our churches.
I'd like to just add one thing. When Granger Westberg talks about if someone would come into your area and just ask you, what are the health institutions in your community? Very often people will think of the hospital or clinics, or, you know, if something is a specialty clinic, they'll name that. But he said, what you're not considering is that your best places of health are where people get together, like the church and the school system, where you have a chance to impact people. And I know I put this in a terrible place, but why the church is a place of health, whoops, what did we do with it? Oh, I don't have it up there, but one of the reasons that the church is a good place, it's an already established place that people know and trust. It's in their neighborhood, it impacts all age groups from birth to death. If you're trying to do education in a public school, for example, you can have a really good job of educating the children as to health needs, but what do you do with the people that are younger or older? And it has regularly scheduled meetings 52 times a year at least. And the list goes on and on. So he said, be sure to think of this as a place where you can impact health when people are looking at their own values. They're also looking at how their health relates to their personal values, stewardship of your own body, your gifts, that people are taught to love their neighbors so that the health extends to other people in the community.
So what questions would you like to ask? I mean, we could keep going forever.
What kind of networking are they doing within the ones that are parish nurses? Are they scattered regionally and in synodical levels?
Okay, well, we have probably about 10 different denominations now that are represented in parish nursing. And yes, they're scattered from Alaska to Northern California and over to Montana. But we find that in the city areas now, there are getting to be more and more nurses, and it doesn't seem to matter to them if one is Catholic and one is Lutheran and one is Methodist. They really have found ways to share with each other. and where one nurse feels that she's far better at talking with seniors, another feels better talking with Sunday school children. And so there is beginning to be that kind of sharing and that kind of partnership. I think Northwest Parish Nurse Ministries is beginning to partnership a lot with Lutheran Family Service because we see so many possibilities there. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Are these nurses paid?
Oh, that's a good question.
I think nurses are so busy 40 hours a week that if you ask them to do all this volunteer work, I'm just wondering.
Okay. Sure. Well, and the majority of parish nurses are unpaid, and the majority of them have another job besides. But as many nurses say to me, you know, I don't really feel like my gift is teaching Sunday school, but I certainly know that I want to use my nursing skills within the church community. And so the parish nurse usually acts as a coordinator of a health ministry within the congregation. And we always say it over and over and over again, you don't have to do everything. Part of it is to be the catalyst and the coordinator of this program.
I'm just curious about like how many hours a week many of the parish nurses are actually putting into this function.
Okay.
Is it like, you know, just on Sunday, or is it spread out? How are they fitting that in around the rest of their lives?
Okay. There are some that are hired part-time and don't have another part-time job. So they're hired part-time, so they're there at least 20 hours a week. Most of them say it's 30 hours a week, and closer probably to 40 hours a week. But the ones that work, maybe some of them put between 8 to 10 hours a week in. And usually Sunday is one day that they do. But then they come in at choir practice time, and they might just have their office open. And if there's a special event during the week where they might do blood pressures at that time, you know, if there is a Wednesday afternoon lunch that for the seniors, they might come in at that time. So it really varies a lot. I have one nurse that says she puts in 8 hours a month, but she gets more done in 8 hours a month than most people do, you know, working full time.
On the national level, it's varied. There are some nurses in some areas, particularly in the Northwest, that work on a paid model. Some of them are paid for 10 hours a week. Some of them are paid for half time. And the nurses are sometimes encouraged to say, well, I will work in this capacity for a period of 6 months or a year to show what this program can do for your congregation. After this time, I would like the council to reconsider and see what my worth is, and then I would like to be considered for salary. And when Annette was talking about unpaid and someone mentioned volunteer, we're trying to switch to the unpaid word rather than volunteer, because it always sounds like you can slip from unpaid to paid, but if you're a volunteer, you're a volunteer forever. So we're looking at making this a position that the church sees as quite valuable to its mission statement.
How about issues of liability and that type of thing for the nurse, her license and her practice?
Right. Well, she must be licensed in the state which she practices in, and we have someone from the nurse, like the Oregon Nurses Association, that comes to talk about licensure and what, you know, how the parish nurse falls under that. And as far as liability insurance, McGinnis Company has written up a policy for parish nurses, but we find that Church Mutual probably has a cheaper policy than McGinnis does, and evidently the coverage is the same. So we recommend, first of all, that you have your own individual policy, liability insurance. And we do recommend that churches look at their insurance policy. Lutheran churches are notorious for having bad policies as far as nurses in churches. I have not read one yet or heard of one yet that didn't exclude specifically nurses. Whereas some churches, I think it's the Methodist Church, their policies generally include the nurse.
Because part of the program, are the churches that are concerned about that they themselves might be...
Right, and that's why we suggest McGinnis, which covers the church.
I'd like to add a little bit to that, too. We're talking about parish nurse, but it's a broader concept of health ministry. And why there needs to be a parish nurse, well, there doesn't actually, but we encourage it, as Granger Westberg has, because the church, the nurse is the one who has the ability to triage, to interface, as we talk about referral source, one of the roles, to know how to relate to different agencies, to be able to say, well, this need seems to be in this area, I'm going to refer to this area. If there's not a registered nurse in a church, you can still have a very active health ministry. If there's a licensed practical nurse, for example, that wants to assume some of this, this can work also. But to be a parish nurse, that's a registered name, and it does imply a registered nurse who has an active current license that's operating under the five roles that we have listed here. And that is a very set term, so I just want you to be familiar with that. But health ministries are teams, and the teams can be people that are interested in health promotion in their congregation. They can be physicians, dentists, pharmacists, physical therapists, etc.
I just want to say I'm a physician in who specializes in medical oncology. Mm-hmm. And I live in a community of about 100,000. We currently have three congregations of parish nurses, and my own congregation is going to be the fourth.
Wow.
We're going to fund this person. I think you have to pay these people. And I think the other thing that's important to know is that the parish nurse doesn't do all the work. We see the parish nurse in our congregation as being a coordinator, director of volunteers, and I've had several of my patients already who have had, in our community, have had parish nurse care. I just had a guy who died of pancreatic cancer, who during the course of about an 18-month illness, he had hospice involvement and things like that, but the parish nurse was able to mobilize his spiritual values and in decision making about whether he wanted certain kinds of treatment, so that his interface wasn't just with me, it was also with his basic values, and we shared a lot of values, so it was easy. But I think there's a role here about choosing healthcare. The person with a brain tumor, for example, may have been offered different kinds of treatment, and by a certain amount of time. At quite a price, and so there's those kinds of things that the parishioners can help with. I also just want to say that I also belong to an organization called a Healthcare Forum. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yes.
That's through building healthier communities. And the parishioners program is one component, but I think there's also a lot to do with housing, violence prevention, employment, that as we visualize what our communities want to look like, health illness prevention is only one piece of it.
Thank you. Very good.
One thing that we like to encourage the nurses to do early on is to look at the advanced directives with their congregations, because in a faith community, again, where you're looking at your own faith values, that is a lot easier than being approached as you enter the hospital and somebody asks you, what would you like to do if you're not able to make decisions on your own, and to get discussions going.
Anything else?
Yes. I'm wondering about the nurses' involvement in getting prepared for disasters such as earthquakes, fire.
Oh, good question here. Yeah, actually, the American Red Cross in Portland has approached us to ask if we could mobilize our parish nurses for some training in that area, because it seems like a natural kind of thing that if there was a disaster that they would be mobilized. Why not? That's what we're there for, is to help people. And the other thing we do is, I got really tired. Well, I have to tell you, okay, I'm notorious. I go to a very small church, but I am notorious for saying the wrong things because I don't like it when I see people standing alone, and I want them to feel welcome. And there was an earthquake in California, and I walked up to this woman and said to her, now why was it no one was ready for that earthquake? And she just looked, she gave me this really strange look, and she said, well, that's what I do for the state of Oregon, is I try to get people to get prepared. And I thought, well, that wasn't a bad connection, not a bad line. I'm glad I used that one. It was better than the one I had used before, but I'll tell you about that one. But anyway, so the two of us are going to do, well, we've already done it with the parish nurses, where we've gotten the information together from the Red Cross and have said to them, go into your churches. Is there any reason why people don't have water, at least, for an earthquake? And there are a lot of things people can do to get to be ready and to be prepared. And so we do feel that parish nursing is one of those. It's just, there are so many things to tell you about that parish nurses do that, I guess that's the reason that they gave three more sessions, but that won't cover it. No, I was going to say that the last person in church that I'd gone up to and I said, you know, good morning, she said, you'll have to speak up. I'm wearing hearing aids. And I said in this very loud voice where everyone turned around, how long have you had AIDS? Oh. And I kind of died all the next week thinking, well, that wasn't very nice. I mean, how? But she wrote a letter to the church council saying, I've come to this church for over 2 years and no one has ever asked me, has ever greeted me. And the person that did embarrass themselves, but they really made me chuckle all week. So that was good to know. So. Any other questions?
Has there been much done with the pastors working with the parish nurses to help give some support for their own spiritual growth? And the nurses I've talked to have done a lot with prayer with their patients and with people. They need some kind of nurturing too.
Yes. And you know, you mean the pastors?
Well, the pastor
and the parish nurse. Yeah. Okay. And the parish nurses really do try to get together in a supportive group at least once a month. And the pastors, this is what we're trying to work out with Lutheran Family Service is to work out ways that towards wellness for pastors, because I don't know that anyone has really put together a very good program. I know there's one pastor here. Have they put together any really good wellness programs for pastors?
Yes. At a lot of our pastoral conferences, they're dealing with how do you guys take care of yourselves.
Aha.
We did a blood pressure check at one of the synod conferences, and mostly they were pastors, and we found so much hypertension that yeah. It was just amazing.
And we also had them all do a health risk appraisal. And I was telling them in introducing the health risk appraisal, I told them about following a car once that we could see that the car was in really bad shape, and we didn't know how bad a shape it was in until a wheel spun off of the car and went into the field and started the field on fire. My husband runs to the field, and there was all the men in the car ran out to the field, but the woman remained in the car. And so I went to her, and it was a Sunday morning, and I said to her, oh, I'm so sorry this happened. She says, well, I should have known it was going to happen. And I thought, well, you know, she realizes that they haven't taken very good care of this car. She said, we went to church this morning, and so the devil is trying to get us. So I told the pastors, please don't use bad theology to explain your poor habits. But yes, we did find the health risk appraisals actually did. I've had a lot of really positive feedback now from pastors that have said that it did get them to start thinking about what areas of their lives that they needed to look at some changes. And exercise was a big one, and weight reduction was another. Yes.
I understood the question to ask what activities or meetings by the pastor with the nurse helps the nurse to increase their spirituality.
Okay. And I think that the, okay, and that's part of the team ministry of the pastor and the nurse. And I would hope that it would be mutually very supportive.
Do you do that in any of the training? Is that part of the support?
It's part of the basic training, and we've tried to incorporate a very strong spirituality component
within the training. Yeah.